dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a bit of a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. And a key part of that is Latin America. We talk about it with some regularity here, particularly with one of our regulars, Roger Noriega, and we're very pleased to have a fellow who has been doing some very important research on the connection between what I think of as our front yard and the Middle East, specifically Iran. His name is Dr. Ilan Berman. He is the vice president for a marvelous organization, the American Foreign Policy Council. He is also a columnist for Forbes.com and the editor, among many publications, the editor of the really important World Almanac of Islamism. And I'm particularly pleased to have Ilan with us to talk a little bit about a really, I think, seminal essay that he has just published in the summer edition of the Middle East Quarterly about Iran courting Latin America. And Ilan, I, as I say, I think you've really synthesized a hugely important problem and brought it into very sharp relief. Congratulations. Let's talk a little bit about what Iran is doing in our front yard and what it might mean for us.
Sure, sure. Well, thank you, Frank. This is, I think, a really interesting thought exercise on a number of levels. First of all, because the idea of Iran's intrusion, the reality of Iran's intrusion in Latin America is a relatively new phenomenon from our perspective. We really haven't begun to pay attention to it until October of last year when the Iranian Revolutionary Guards were implicated in attempting to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to Washington,
Washington.
Here in town. So therefore, you know, now there's a great deal of attention being paid, but there's not a lot of understanding of what Iran is doing, how it's doing it, and what Iran wants to achieve. And the second reason why I think this is sort of an object worthy of study is because I'm not a Latin America expert, I'm an Iran expert, but the thing that's missing in the debate currently that you see playing out in the media is an understanding of what Iran's strategic intentions are. You see a lot of activity, and you see a lot of friendship on the part of the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and, for example, Venezuelan strongman Hugo Chavez, but you don't really see the underlying strategy that animates it. So I've spent a lot of time looking at precisely what that is.
Let's go through the sort of four elements that you've talked about in this Middle East Quarterly paper, because you really, I think, very nicely sort of dissect what's going on here. The first of your points was that these kinds of strategic partnerships or alliances with not just, of course, Chavez, but his proxies and clients in the region as well, is an effort to loosen or perhaps just circumvent and downright undermine the sanctions regime about which we've spent so much time and energy trying to bring to bear to get the Iranians to stop their nuclear weapons program. How are they doing that and to what effect?
Well, sure. The most immediate task that the Iranians have these days, over the last 8 months, you've seen a real ratcheting up of economic pressure on Iran from the U.S. government as well as from, for example, the European Union collectively. And the Iranians are increasingly squeezed. You see this playing out domestically by the rising rate of inflation, the soaring cost of foodstuffs in Iran. And so the Iranians are looking for avenues to access international markets in a very constrained environment. And they've hit upon using areas, and Latin America is not the only one. They're also heavily invested, for example, in Asia, but using geographical areas beyond their immediate periphery to try to access financial markets, to try to conduct business as usual with sympathetic governments, despite international sanctions. And in the context of Latin America, because of Iran's partnership, the partnership it's built up over the last 6.5-7 years with Venezuela, it's been able to really manipulate and manhandle the Venezuelan economy to allow it access to international markets, international trading, using institutions in the Venezuelan economy that aren't yet sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department, aren't proscribed by the Department of Commerce. And so Latin America is at least one ancillary avenue that Iran is using to stay afloat financially.
Ilan, I want to reserve some time for the last of your four sort of strategic objectives. So let's quickly talk about the middle two. Obtaining resources and having the ability to exercise influence for various reasons, again, for circumventing sanctions and projecting its power. Tell us quickly about those two points, if you would. What are examples and why should we care?
Sure. Well, the resource question, I think, is really one of the seminal ones because the common understanding is that Iran's been working on its nuclear program for about a quarter of a century. It's invested dozens of billions of dollars. And there's really, despite what the administration says, despite what everybody says, there's really nothing we can do about it. That's actually not true. In fact, Iran, as its nuclear program has gotten more and more expansive and more mature, has run a growing deficit of raw material, materials such as uranium ore, and it needs to look abroad in order to secure supplies. And that's why you've seen this Iranian intrusion into Latin America to try to shore up uranium supplies, not only uranium, but other minerals as well. But this is a key element of what Iran is trying to do.
So if we wanted to shut this program down, one of the ways that we should be concentrating on is interrupting this flow. How about the influence projection?
Well, it's very clear. It's very clear from the government officials that I've talked to in places like Chile and Bolivia that there is a growing asymmetric presence on the part of the Iranians in Latin America. They are building a cadre of sympathetic individuals. They're also deploying elements of their clerical army, the Revolutionary Guards, into Latin America to build up both an ideological affinity among local radical groups and also to build up what is potentially an operational presence that can be used under certain circumstances against the United States.
Yeah, to some extent, this is being done under the cover of embassies that they've been building aggressively in the region. Let's come to that last bit because we've only got a couple of minutes and I really want to make sure we cover this. Ilan Berman is our guest, the vice president for the American Foreign Policy Council and author of a very important essay at Middle East Quarterly's summer 2012 edition, Iran Courts Latin America. The asymmetrical ability to engage in terroristic attacks against the United States homeland is one of the other really cautionary warnings that you're offering, Ilan. Give us a few examples of that and how serious a threat it represents.
Well, I think the common thread here, and you see this playing out on multiple dimensions, is that we are rapidly approaching a conflict with Iran. Iran cannot challenge us in conventional military terms, and so Iran is looking for ways in which it can reach out and touch the U.S. homeland. And the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, talked about this when he testified before the Senate earlier this year. He talked about the fact that the strategic calculus in Tehran is changing, and the Iranian regime is increasingly willing to reach out and attack the U.S. homeland. And we saw this in October of 2011 in the attempted attack against the Saudi ambassador. Increasingly, what's clear is that Latin America, which once was used as a sort of a support theater, a theater for support operations, is now an operational theater where they have enough assets deployed that they can reach out and touch us if they want to.
Ilan, one of the things that we've heard about, but it isn't getting a whole lot of attention, what is your assessment of the effort that the Iranians are purportedly making with the Venezuelans to build a missile base in Venezuela?
Well, I think that this is obviously a hugely important, hugely significant development if it's proven, because it's really a red line on the part of the Iranians, but even more directly a red line on the part of the Venezuelan government in terms of the threat that they pose to the U.S. homeland. But I think it's what's clear so far is that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. There isn't a smoking gun yet, but you see telltale signs of development that could be very, very nefarious in nature. For example, the purchasing of ballistic missile specific ceramic flooring and things like that that you would use to test engines. But what's interesting is that this all comes as part of a larger conversation that Iran is having with Venezuela about developing military technology that Iran might not be comfortable doing in its own homeland because of sanctions, because of international oversight. Venezuela is emerging as, I think, what could be a very significant potential source of ancillary military development for the Iranian regime.
We're hearing endlessly, unfortunately, that it seems the president does not view Venezuela as a threat. The outgoing Southcom commander does not view Venezuela as a threat. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along seems to be kind of the mantra. And I think what you've done with this latest essay, Ilan Berman, and all of the work that you've been involved in, your testimonies and so on at the American Foreign Policy Council, really helps provide a necessary counter narrative that we had best be focusing on, because this this conflict, I'm afraid you're right, is coming with Iran, and it may bite us very badly if we're not mindful of these asymmetric capabilities that they will be bringing to bear. Ilan, thank you for your time today, and we'll look forward to visiting with you more about this in the near future.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any other junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. Now, I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
We could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jessica Zuckerman, research fellow with the highly esteemed Heritage Foundation. She works in its Allison Foreign Policy Studies Center, and she has been reporting on some very important issues that I think don't get nearly enough coverage. And one of them is a kind of hardy perennial here for sure, and that is this threat of electromagnetic pulse attack. And Jessica, you have recently written with your colleague Mikhaila Bendikova an important argument for raising the profile and public awareness about this threat. Remind us what EMP is and why it is imperative that we be very alert to the danger it represents and doing more to remedy the threat.
Well, it sounds like something out of a fiction story. Indeed, it sounds very similar to the plot of the new television show, Revolution, coming out in the fall, I believe. An EMP attack, which stands for electromagnetic pulse, would knock out the nation's electrical system, essentially knocking us back to before the industrial age. By releasing a high-intensity burst of energy, this energy would really go through our electrical systems and kill them for all intensive purposes, leaving us without many things. Our basic electrical capabilities, most cars would become inoperable, airplanes would literally fall from the sky, even water, sewer, cell phones, everything would be rendered useless.
So this is the sort of thing that could be precipitated by what means? How realistic is the threat that someone could inflict this kind of, incalculably devastating damage upon us?
Well, there's a few different ways this could happen. The one that's talked about the most is from a nuclear weapon detonated high in our altitude. And this isn't just long-range missiles that are needed to create this. Even short-range missiles launched from ships off the coast of the U.S. could impact us. And in fact, 30 countries, including Iran and North Korea, currently possess the ballistic missile capabilities needed to carry out an EMP. But it's not just from nuclear weapons. We've seen the fact that solar flares have the potential to cause an EMP effect. And that's something we need to be concerned about in this country.
And particularly, as I understand it, Jessica, that the sun goes through cycles and is in or approaching one in which this could be evidenced, this kind of intensive geomagnetic storm that could trigger effects bathing much of the world, not just the United States, but lots of countries with this intense electromagnetic pulse effect. The problem, whether it's man-caused or whether it's naturally induced, is really one of vulnerability to these kinds of phenomena. What can be done to mitigate either the so-called man-caused disasters or those that the sun might inflict?
Well, first of all, we should be prepared. One way to help mitigate the man-made effects of an EMP or the nuclear weapons would be to make sure the U.S. is developing and deploying space-based missile defense. We should also be working on our intelligence to make sure we're aware of what countries are truly capable of deploying an EMP-type weapon. And then at home, we need to make sure we're prepared by integrating this into our emergency response plans and addressing our critical infrastructure and looking at how resilient it would be in the face of an EMP threat and how we would recover.
Again, we're speaking with Jessica Zuckerman, who is a research associate at the Heritage Foundation specializing in homeland security. And Jessica, I know there's been a lot of talk about this for some time. What specifically could be done to produce more protection for our electrical grid? Specifically, I guess the transformers are the sort of critical nodes that are particularly vulnerable to this. And is there a legislative initiative underway that that might help, again, get these kind of mitigating steps taken? And specifically talk a little bit about this EMP Threat Awareness Day that you have proposed as a means of trying to help that kind of legislative program go forward.
Well, I'm not a scientist, but I do know that the technology is out there to help look at hardening our infrastructure, particularly our electrical systems, and also looking at our cyber systems, which are not only dependent entirely on the electrical system, but an EMP pulse could also really fry the cyber grid as well in the cyber circuits. What we're calling for here at Heritage is for Congress to pay more attention to the threat and really begin hearty debate on the issue to make sure the nation is prepared. And we're calling for them to do that by establishing today, August 15th, as National EMP Awareness Day. And we picked today because it's the anniversary of the 2003 Northeast blackout, which left 55 million people without power, which was just a taste of what could happen if an EMP did occur in the Northeast United States, except for in the case of an EMP, the power wouldn't be restored in a matter of days like it was 9 years ago.
Yeah, when a branch fell on on electrical wires, I recall. When we talk about, I think particularly the SHIELD Act as a legislative vehicle, its co-sponsors, I believe principally are Congressman Trent Franks of Arizona and Congressman Roscoe Bartlett of Maryland. We had, in fact, a conversation conversation with Congressman Bartlett last week, Jessica Zuckerman. Clearly, awareness of the kind that you're calling for on a national day of recognition would do a lot to help impel this thing along. But I guess, folks, I just would say to you that if we don't fix this problem, we will rue the day and many, many, many days to come for our failure to take relatively inexpensive and effective measures to mitigate this danger. Jessica, I thank you for calling this idea and the danger that it represents to our attention. Let me switch gears. You've also written recently about something called the Chemical Facilities Anti-Terror Standards Program. It's a mouthful. It's something that's been on the books for a while. You're somewhat critical of it. It's up for renewal, as I understand it, because this legislation that established these standards is due to expire in October. Tell us how serious a threat there is inherent in these chemical facilities, how important it is that we ensure that they're properly protected, and what some of your ideas are for doing it better than we're doing it today.
Well, indeed, in the years since 9/11 and even before that, we've seen that terrorists are really out to cause large-scale harm, and in some ways they have targeted chemical facilities. They've also looked to get chemicals from these facilities and use them in their weapons. We saw this in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, for instance. So while we can't discount the threat of terrorism at our chemical facilities, we do need to make sure we're protecting them properly. And what the CFATS, which is the Chemical Facility Anti-Terrorism Standards for short, does is really over-regulate the standards and not allow the private sector to have sufficient say in making market-conscious and common-sense policies to protect the people and our chemical security measures.
And to the extent that we've been doing it less competently than we could, can you give us a couple of examples of how improvements could be made that would be both market-friendly and more effective, as I think there's no getting around it. If people get their hands on chemicals or simply blow up some of these facilities, it's a huge, huge problem.
Well, one of the things we need to make sure is that our chemical regulations and our chemical security measures are truly risk-based. And this is something we talk about throughout Homeland Security, even passenger screening, for instance. We want to make sure that we're focusing our resources at those targets or those threats that really offer the greatest potential to harm the United States and its people. And one of the flaws we've seen in the CFATS program is that they've had a lot of issues determining which facilities really are high-risk facilities and which need the greatest protection and the greatest level of regulation. And that's really just one of the steps that can help us. We also need to make sure that we have sufficient transparency and we're talking to the private sector and integrating them into these conversations.
Well, it seems eminently reasonable, and I would like to think that that's what was done in the first place. But if it hasn't been, it ought to be done now, because as with the electrical grid, so much of this capacity and potential threat is, of course, as you know, Jessica Zuckerman, in the private sector's hands. They've got to be part of the solution to the problem and getting their best ideas on how to ensure their facilities are secured unmistakably a necessary measure in protecting them, well, and frankly, protecting us. Jessica Zuckerman of the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for the good work you all are doing at Heritage. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Adam Credo about President Obama's dubious donors and some of his political allies. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it. At www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney and his running mate, Representative Paul Ryan, were recently sharply criticized over their commitment to reverse massive budget cuts Team Obama is making at the expense of our military capabilities and national security. What made this attack notable and potentially very damaging to the GOP standard bearers is that it came not from the Democrats, but from a prominent Republican political operative, Grover Norquist. It's hard to see how his contention that Messrs. Romney and Ryan can't be trusted to spend wisely on defense will help anybody but their opponents. Grover Norquist has no expertise on national security, and his judgment on such matters is deeply flawed. If Republicans lose this fall, Norquist's undermining of the GOP ticket on a critical issue may be partly why. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fastballing philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Adam Credo. He is one of the bright lights at one of the most important new media outlets in Washington. It's called the Washington Free Beacon. Adam is a senior writer there and has been breaking a number of stories that have bearing on the national security portfolio that we cover here, and it's always great to have him with us. Adam, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks for having me, Frank. I appreciate it.
Let's visit a little bit about something you've been writing about this week concerning a colorful character by the name of Case Lowell. Tell us who he is and what you have been finding out about him, and in particular, his relationship to the Obama administration.
Absolutely. So Case Lowell is an interesting figure. He's an oil mogul. He's a CEO over at a company called KMAC International, and they traffic in oil and gas. They're a conglomerate. They're active in many, many places across the globe. But Case is also a very prolific Democratic donor. He's donated to the Obama campaign recently, even as recently as late last year, and he's a Clinton family confidant. He's actually accompanied former President Clinton to regions, I believe it was Africa. So he's very closely tied to the Democratic Party. But Case is also involved in a lawsuit currently, and this is a pretty interesting case. He allegedly was caught trying to purchase about $10 million worth of gold from a Congolese warlord who has really done some terrible things, ethnic cleansing massacres. And Lowell, through his company, was caught trying to pay millions of dollars to chase this gold down. And it's a plot that also involved the NBA All-Star Dikembe Mutombo. And there were not a lot of details known about this when I first wrote about it. But since then, a lawsuit has been brought about against Case and against KMAC, his company. And one of the key people in this case, a guy named Carlos St. Mary, actually gave sworn deposition, and I got a hold of it. And he really takes you through quite an unbelievable story of traveling to Nigeria, traveling to Congo, and trying to chase this gold down before finally being arrested by authorities. So it's quite unbelievable.
And Adam, the connection between this guy and the sort of Team Obama operation is exactly what?
Right. So this is another interesting piece of it, and a lot of foreign policy experts have questioned what's happening here, because Case was appointed to a White House trade advisory board. It's the Advisory Committee for Trade Policy and Negotiations. And that happened in 2010. And not soon after that, Case got caught up in this Congolese gold plot, allegedly. And even the United Nations has cited him for this. So right now, Case's name can no longer be found on the list of trade advisors.
He's disappeared, has he?
A couple months ago. He had disappeared. And, you know, he was asked in his own testimony, where he invoked the Fifth Amendment to not incriminate himself, from my count, about 134 times. And he was asked about this, you know, what happened? Did you resign from the White House board because of this? But he would not answer.
Interesting. And in the course of not incriminating himself, obviously he's created, as is usually the case, the impression that he's got something to hide, at the very least. But what's in public light, and you've documented in your piece, Adam Credo, at the Washington Free Beacon under the heading Former Obama Advisor Takes the Fifth, is extensive contributions to both the Obama campaigns and to the Democratic National Committees of Bundler and all that. Give us a sense of the magnitude of this. And does it have some bearing on how his case is being handled, in your judgment?
Yeah, it's interesting to look at that. And he has donated quite a lot of money. You're right. According to public records, he gave $35,800 to the Obama Victory Fund. That was in late 2011. And he also gave $30,800 to the DNC. And you can also see him contributing money to a slew of Democratic congressional campaigns. I believe I saw Charlie Rangel on there, among others. So this is not insignificant amounts of money. This is a lot of money. So it has led people to question what's happening with this case. But, you know, one interesting aspect of this is that the case is taking place in Texas, and it's a civil case. It's not a criminal case. The case was brought by the fellow whose airplane was seized in this whole gold exchange. They were trying to fly the gold back to the United States, obviously, from the Congo. And in the process, the Gulfstream jet that they were using was seized. And this jet was leased to Lowell and KMAC. So the fellow in Texas is trying to recoup the damages. I believe the company defaulted on a loan. So they're trying to get back
$17 million. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, $17 million. They're trying to get back quite a large sum of money. So because it's a civil case, and I believe that I heard in Texas, juries are often instructed to interpret pleading the Fifth Amendment, not answering questions as implicit guilt. So that could be interesting when this finally goes to trial and it's scheduled for September. So
yeah, needless to say, Adam Credo, this is a fascinating story, just an insight into how bizarre and arcane sometimes these bundlers and their machinations can be, and we appreciate very much your putting your spotlight on it and sharing it with us. Adam, another colorful character in the Team Obama world, a political figure that you've been covering in Missouri, didn't do so well, I guess, in the recent election there. But tell us about this fellow MD Rabbi Alam, not a Jewish rabbi, I take it.
No, not a Jewish rabbi, Bangladeshi originally, and a longtime Democratic foot soldier in the Missouri area, actually a Democratic Party caucus chairman. He created a group and chairs a group called the National Democratic Party Asian American Caucus, and that liaises with the DNC. And MD Alam also was running up until last week to become Missouri's Secretary of State. And this is an issue we followed before the primary took place, which he did lose. But MD Alam also has some interesting beliefs about 9/11. He believes things such that there were no Jewish people murdered in 9/11, or that 9/11 was somehow a holiday for Jewish people. All of things that are completely untrue and have been thoroughly debunked. But now MD, since losing his bid to become Secretary of State, has started a political action committee. And according to its website, so long as it's not been altered since we reported on this, they're looking to elect Muslim candidates who are anti-Zionist and who believe, according to them, this is a quote, that the war on terror is a hoax and that the official story of 9/11 is not true.
Wow. This is the American Muslim Political Action Committee, as I understand it. And
newly incorporated.
Yeah, this would seem to be a real liability for the Democrats and the Obama administration at a moment when they're obviously making a rather concerted play for Jewish votes. I would think it would be pretty offensive to an awful lot of other Americans as well. What's the take on how this guy, Rabbi Alam, is being handled by his so-called Democratic brothers in politics?
Well, you know, certainly Democrats here in D.C. who see this for what it is have denounced him. But I think what people try to say when they read these stories is, well, he's not very well known. He's not very prominent. Nobody knows who the guy is. But if you look at his record, he has for a very long time liaised with the Democratic Party and even President Obama. He served as a satellite campaign manager in 2008 for then candidate Obama. And he's been invited to the White House since then. He also, like I said, has liaised with the DNC, and I believe a organization of his is hosted on their website. So this is a known person. This is a known quantity. This is a longtime Democrat. And he's actually already said that he wants to run for the U.S. Senate in 2016.
Well, this will be colorful. We will be watching it, as I know you will be. Again, Adam Credo of the Washington Free Beacon, thank you for this very, very interesting update and all the great work that you and your team are doing at the Free Beacon. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will be talking with Jim Hansen. We'll be getting his boots-on-the-ground perspective on, well, among other things, Grover Norquist's efforts to take on Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy. Eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for our wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice. nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Medis system, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Medis system to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Medis system by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Medis system from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight. 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jim Hansen, our duty expert on the boots on the ground view of these highfalutin national security issues we talk about a lot here at Secure Freedom Radio. And Jim, welcome back. We're visiting at a time when a very interesting drama is beginning to play out. Grover Norquist, a man that I have raised a lot of concerns about for a long time, an anti-tax activist, has now taken rather aggressive shots at Governor Mitt Romney and his vice presidential running mate, Representative Paul Ryan, on the grounds that, well, they really can't be trusted on defense matters. They will be too receptive to wasteful defense spending. Now, I can understand this kind of criticism coming from the leftists, some of whom Grover hangs with quite a bit, as a matter of fact, but what's up with this coming from a guy who's supposedly an iconic Republican political activist?
I don't know what his goal is. You know, I mean, well, I guess and it's been a standard thing for him for a while. I think anybody really does. I trust Romney and Ryan to take care of the defense budget. And I think given both of them have a very strong efficiency-based, pragmatic approach to spending our tax dollars, you'd think that a tax guy like Grover would feel good about having them in, you know, as opposed to John McCain, who would obviously be in the pockets of the military as a former military guy. You know, Romney and Ryan are a team that is budget-focused and efficiency-driven. The Pentagon needs that. You know, I mean, I'm not one of those people who thinks you have to have a military background to be president or anything else. I don't buy the chicken hawk argument from anybody on either side. I want people who understand that they have a responsibility to the taxpayer and to the country's security. And I think Romney and Ryan are a great combination to do the best with that. So I don't know what he's doing, Frank.
Well, the principal message seems to be that that you're going to now have to raise taxes to get away from this sequestration train wreck that's coming down. This is the another $500 billion worth of cuts on top of about $800 billion that have already been programmed for the Pentagon, and they're widely being described, particularly the way this is being applied, as you know, Jim Henson, in an across-the-board fashion as something that will really be devastating for the national security. And Grover, obviously, is less concerned about the national security, shall we say. I believe that he's been working for a bunch of Islamists for a long time, which may further explain what he's doing here, but at the very minimum, he's got his eye exclusively on the taxes issue. And Jim, I guess what I'm really worried about is to the extent you have somebody in the Republican circles fragging his own team, as Grover Norquist is doing, it can only benefit the opponents and the people who are trying to bring about this train wreck. And maybe that, again, is in the interest of the Muslim Brotherhood. I certainly don't think it's in the interest of the United States. So to the extent that Grover Norquist is doing this, I sure hope that people are going to be pushing back hard in the Romney campaign. But one of the other issues, Jim, that I wanted to visit with you about, we talk about it a lot here, is the unhappy state of affairs in Afghanistan at the moment. We have a report on National Public Radio this morning that the administration is now beginning to move more aggressively in the direction of releasing five top Taliban commanders and leaders in exchange for a prisoner of war that sadly has been in Taliban hands now for several years, and as a lubricant to trying to get the Taliban to some sort of negotiating table where I guess they will receive our surrender. What's up with this, and how bad an idea is it to let these five seriously bad Taliban guys out?
Yeah, I am never a fan of negotiating with terrorists. I can tell you there has been an awful lot of activity behind the scenes trying to get Bo Bergdahl released, our POW. I mean, we have tried everything that anybody can think of to try and make that happen, and just have been unable to reach any kind of an agreement up to what seems to be now the ante up to releasing these five Taliban guys. It's a bad idea, but it fits perfectly with Obama's plan of trying to find some people in the Taliban that, like you said, that he can more or less peacefully mission accomplish himself out of the war with. You know, I hate to call it a surrender. It's damn close. And, you know, the negotiations have been going on with the Taliban for 3 years now, for basically the entire Obama term. We have not been trying to win the war. We've been trying to leave the war and end the war. And I think it's a disgrace that he sent troops over there without any inclination towards trying to win it. He owes, you know, their blood is on his hands. And now he's got to try to find Taliban he can turn the country over to or make a deal with that don't embarrass him before the election. So I don't think we'll see anything before then, I think what we'll see is, you know, negotiations along those routes. And if he can get the POW released, he thinks he'll get a publicity bump. So as usual, it's a politically driven situation, and Obama's doing what he does best.
Yeah. What I find particularly troubling is that what we know of these Taliban detainees in Guantanamo Bay, Jim Henson, is they are really some of the worst of the worst. These are killers. These are people who have commanded Taliban operations in the past. They're the former defense minister of the Taliban government and the like. And one of the things seems to me to be sure, we've had a pretty bad experience, Jim, as you know, with what I guess the fancy term for it is recidivism. People being sprung from Guantanamo Bay and going right back to the battlefield, there's no doubt that these five will as well. And the notion that Qatar, which is, I guess, where we're going to turn them over to if the administration has its way, will actually hold them, will keep them from getting back onto the battlefield is laughable. But it really raises this question that you may choose to recoil from the term surrender. I don't see how it can be anything else, especially if we help them intensify the military assault, reminiscent maybe of the North Vietnamese, you know, liberating South Vietnam when we failed to stand with it.
Yeah, I wish you were wrong, Frank. And like I said, I don't like to say the word, but we've lost the war. If we surrender, I guess in all but the word we have. So it's a shameful situation, and this is going to make it worse. And yeah, those guys will be back commanding Taliban, killing innocents, and probably, you know, running provinces in Afghanistan in the not-too-distant future. Woohoo!
It's a shameful thing, and I hope it will be something that the public repudiates in this balloting coming up. Jim, lastly, very quickly, we talked a little bit about Grover Norquist and the Muslim Brotherhood earlier. They seem to be on a roll in Egypt. Several top generals were cashiered. This suggests that another institution is coming under their sway, armed, by the way, with an awful lot of advanced American weaponry. What do you see going on there, and how serious a problem does that represent in your view?
Yeah, this is pretty good. I mean, the thing was, these generals knew their days were numbered, and they've got all their money offshore, so I assume they're all going to Dubai to move into luxury, you know, apartments up in the sky. And now the replacements, I'm sure, will maintain a firm control over the Islamists. You know, they'll probably appoint some very secular guys and moderates to watch over it. Or they'll appoint their buddies who have their same tendencies. It's the exact situation you have been saying is going to happen since the Arab Spring sprung, and it's going to get much, much worse. Should be fun to watch.
I guess, Jim, we're hearing that the courts are the last bastion, and I fear that their likely independence of the Brotherhood and the Islamists more generally is going to be a fleeting one at best. And Jim, just to close up, and we got to go, but to the extent that arsenal is in fact going to be in the hands of the Islamists, how worrying should that be for us and our friends like the Israelis in the region?
I worry less about the active big army type gear we have, because if they roll that stuff against us, it's all a generation plus behind us. They don't have our best stuff, and we take them out, and they suck at using it. You know, so they don't have the capability to actually take anything on, and if they do, we'll squash them like bugs. I think it's more the insurgency, the guerrilla, the support for Islamist movements in the region that worries me a whole lot more and can cause, you know, it's asymmetric attacks rather than the symmetric. They're not going to take us on force.
We'll see, and we'll stay tuned, and we'll get your boots on the ground perspective. Jim Henson, as always, thanks for joining us. Keep up the good work at Apsio and with the Warrior Legacy Foundation. Come back to us again next week. We'll talk to the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.